Chapter 6. Practical applications of the skillful will. The number of these applications is practically endless. A wide range of specific psychological techniques based on the laws given in the previous chapter have been developed and tested in the field and are available for implementation. We then have a footnote. They are described in part 2 of my book Psychosynthesis. While new ones are being continually developed, it might be said that they include the whole field of applied psychosynthesis. While an exposition of them is outside the scope of this book, I will describe a few in some detail as typical examples and for their outstanding usefulness in a variety of common situations. 1. Realizing the value of the will. This exercise, discussed on pages 36 and 37 as a preliminary to the gymnastics of the will, is itself based on the skillful use of the will. In performing it, we apply the existing strength of our will, no matter how small, to act on our imagination and to use its power to realize the great value of having an effective will. This realization, in turn, arouses urges, desires, and emotions, all aligned with our initial intention, that is, with the original direction of our will. This procedure of vividly imagining the limitations and drawbacks of an existing condition we want to change, and the advantages of changing it, is very valuable to generate momentum before initiating any kind of inner or outer activity. It is a psychological analogue to power steering, or to the servo brakes of an automobile, or to the many other devices that, by means of mechanical advantage, allow man to augment his physical strength by practically any desired amount. 2. Technique of substitution. Most of us have had the experience at some time or other of some thought, tune, verse or sentence which captures our attention and is able to hold it for a long period of time, occasionally for hours, despite our attempts to get rid of it. In extreme forms, this condition can even become pathological. And if, in trying not to think about something, we concentrate directly on not thinking about it, it will tend, perversely, to become more central and vivid in our awareness. Yet if we choose any other subject or image and direct our attention to it, we find that the unwanted thought will gradually become more peripheral and tenuous, and eventually fade away altogether. This is a simple application of the technique of substitution. It is based on Law 6, page 56, according to which attention centered on an object gives it energy, making it more important in our awareness. Continued attention tends to increase interest, and interest in turn reinforces the attention, thus creating a positive feedback loop. When the unwanted thought or image draws our awareness, it becomes like a magnet that captures our attention and continues to draw increasing energy from it. So, if we pit the strength of our will directly against it, we are likely to fail. But if we use a more skillful, less direct and aggressive approach, by deliberately building another center of attraction, we can easily use it to liberate our captive attention. It might be argued that all we are doing is to displace our attention from one image to another. This is certainly the case, but the point is that the second image is the one of our choice, and we choose that it be of greater usefulness than the first one. So this technique has practical application in dealing with all kinds of annoying, disturbing, and negative recurrent thoughts or images, as well as with undesired or harmful influences. Of course, a word of caution should be given here. As with any technique, substitution may be misused, applied without a clear perception of an individual's existential situation, or without a good sense of appropriate timing. Certain recurrent images and thoughts which are negative and disturbing are clues that an emotional block may exist, and in these cases, if substitution is used before the difficulty has been sufficiently explored, understood and dealt with, it may tend to suppress the material which is trying to emerge into the consciousness. On the other hand, even when the problem has been brought to the surface, worked on, and largely resolved, these images often linger on at a relatively low level of energy, like an old tune or an old habit. In this case, substitution is especially appropriate and effective, for it can help to clear away the debris and make free and clear space in consciousness. Much of the inner clutter in which we try so hard to live and work can be dealt with by this technique of substitution. It can also be useful in regulating and counterbalancing excessively one-sided tendencies within ourselves. This is a more subtle application of the skillful will. The technique of substitution is utilized also in the more general method of psychological breathing and feeding, described next. 3. Psychological breathing and feeding. More than a specific technique, this constitutes a general approach to our everyday life, which can be implemented most effectively through the application of the skillful will. In many ways, our psychological needs resemble our physiological needs. We know that our physical health depends on a number of basic factors, such as a balanced diet, the regulated ingestion and assimilation of food, and the breathing of clean, pure air. We have gained considerable skill in these basic principles of personal hygiene, and in recognizing and avoiding or protecting ourselves from those environmental situations that can produce infection, communicate contagious diseases, or otherwise cause physical harm. Many of the recent, most promising activities in the field of ecology can be seen as an extension of this attitude, and of a personal sense of responsibility as well, to include all of humanity and our whole planet. In the psychological field, on the other hand, our awareness is lagging far behind. A general recognition of the powerful psychological influence of our environment, to which we are all subject, is still lacking, even though the major problems of today, such as war, an increasingly harmful competitive attitude, and the widely prevalent conditions of fear and depression, either belong to, or have their causes in, the psychological domain. Yet at least a beginning in this direction is being made, and a small but rapidly growing minority of people are developing what might be called a psycho-ecological conscience. An interesting indication of this is the emerging awareness of the use of the word vibration by many young people. The terms of good vibrations and bad vibrations are increasingly used to describe what is considered as a favourable or unfavourable psychological environment or condition. It seems timely, therefore, to indicate some of the more common harmful factors which pollute our psychological environment, and to suggest skillful will methods by which we can most effectively deal with them. The principal negative factors are aggressiveness and violence, fear, depression and despondency, greed, and all forms of selfish desire. They are true psychological poisons, which permeate the psychic atmosphere, and careful examination will find them at the root of a very large number of difficulties, both within the individual and within society. In order to deal with them effectively, we need to remember that these psychological poisons exist not only in external surroundings, but also, to a greater or lesser degree, in all of us. We need, therefore, to eliminate them also within ourselves, or reduce them to a minimum. This is a specific task of individual psychosynthesis, and it calls for different techniques from those suitable for gaining protection from external poisons. To be most effective, the two operations should be performed side by side. This is because, on one hand, it is practically impossible to reach such a degree of freedom from internal poisons as to be completely immune to the influence of those coming from the outside world. On the other hand, external poisons tend to feed and intensify the corresponding ones in us. Thus, a vicious circle comes into being. The poisons within us open the door to the influence of the external ones, while the latter intensify the former. A most effective way to break the vicious circle is to withdraw attention deliberately from these psychic poisons. This will liberate the energy of the attention and allow it to be focused elsewhere, in a direction where it will do the most good. The act of this withdrawal of attention is a definite act of skillful will, and in turn contributes to strengthening the will itself. 1. Aggression and violence. The widespread aggression and violence now unleashed throughout humanity are too evident to need pointing out. The first remedial step is to stop intensifying them by unnecessarily focusing attention and interest on them. Yet newspapers, magazines, television programs, and films vie with each other in presenting vivid and dramatic accounts of events and scenes of aggression and violence. All this emphasis can only serve to intensify aggression through the agency of what has been called the feeding power of attention. It would thus be a measure of elementary psychological hygiene, of protection of our mental health, to avoid or at least greatly limit exposure to sensational accounts and illustrations of this kind. This does not mean closing our eyes to aggression and violence, or ignoring their existence. It is one thing to deal with objective information about such conditions for a useful purpose, and quite another to submit ourselves needlessly and indiscriminately to a flood of sensational descriptions and pictures. 2. Fear. This too is a widely diffused poison. Besides personal fears and anxieties, waves of collective fear and panic invade the psychic atmosphere. One of these waves is aroused by the peril of global warfare and the consequent destruction of human life on a vast scale. Also widespread is the apprehensiveness about the economic crises and unemployment, epidemics, criminality, civil violence, and so on. Here again, the first and pressing thing to do is to avoid exacerbating and feeding these fears with unfounded prophecies of catastrophe, and to turn our attention purposely and firmly to areas that are positive and constructive. It is only as we free ourselves from the overwhelming sweep of collective panic about all of these vital issues that we are truly able to do something about them. So paradoxically, a person who is sincerely and deeply concerned with bettering economic conditions, ending war, or the like, will be most effective if he does not open himself completely, even in the name of compassion, to all these influences, but rather is able to maintain a centered and calm focus on specific issues so he can clearly see what needs to be done. 3. Depression and despondency. These are reactions to much that is negative, dark, unjust, and unsatisfying within collective human life. While these conditions have always existed, the present period is witnessing their significant increase, to which the mass communications media are giving an exaggerated and one-sided emphasis. Some respond to these evils with aggression and the urge to destroy the old system by violent action. The reaction of many others, on the other hand, is one of depression, even despair, produced by a feeling of frustration and uselessness. 4. Greed. A fourth kind of psychological poison can be encountered under the general heading of greed. Greed is an expression of selfish desire, which, according to the Buddha's teaching, is at the root of all suffering and unhappiness. Such suffering occurs not only because many desires are unrealistic and thus can never be gratified, but even more because of the very nature of greed, which is such that no satisfaction lasts for long. It always demands something more. There are many kinds of desire. One, the drive towards excessive and unbridled self-assertion, is one of the major causes of aggression and violence. Another is excessive sensuality, in the broadest sense, an inordinate craving for physical pleasures of all kinds. Of this, gluttony, to employ an old-fashioned but expressive term, is a typical expression. The intake of food and drink greatly in excess of bodily needs or unsuited to individual constitutions is too frequently responsible for ill health and premature loss of life. The analogy between food intake and sexual activity has been pointed out by Maslow in the following terms. An excellent parallel may be made between this and the attitude of these self-actualizing people towards food. Food is simultaneously enjoyed and yet regarded as relatively unimportant in the total scheme of life by self-actualizing people. When they do enjoy it, they can enjoy it wholeheartedly and without the slightest tainting with bad attitudes towards animality and the like. And yet ordinarily feeding oneself takes a relatively unimportant place in the total picture. These people do not need sensuality, they simply enjoy it when it occurs. Let us be clear that neither eating nor sexual activity are poisons in themselves. They are natural functions and are inherently necessary for the preservation of the individual and humanity's very life. The pleasure derived from their healthy gratification is good, and it can be enjoyed wholeheartedly without any sense of guilt. When I speak of poison, I mean the attachment that leads to excesses, and above all, the exploitation promoted for commercial purposes which leads to such excesses. We are continually bombarded from all directions by intensive suggestion to make us purchase food and drink, and by an emphasis on sexuality, which is a paramount ingredient of modern books, illustrations, films, television, and pseudo-art. Thus, an exaggerated and artificial stimulation of the sex drive is created, one which is completely different from the healthy, spontaneous, natural instinct. This is a distinction that must be clearly recognized. Another factor connected with sexuality is its current dissociation from the rest of human personality, particularly from its affective aspect. The sexual dissociation manifests the generally committed error of failing to recognize and take into practical account the vital connections linking the various aspects and levels of the human being. In this way, physical, emotional, and mental activities become alienated from one another and come to function separately, causing conflict and inner discord. It is well to be quite clear on the point that no drive, emotion, or desire needs to be repressed or should be condemned on its own account. It is the skillful regulation of its use and manifestations that is needed. Any medicine can become a poison if used unsuitably and in excessive doses, whereas some strong poisons given in minimal doses are curative in appropriate cases. It is precisely the regulatory function of the skillful will that finds here one of its most useful fields of action. A sound psychological hygiene demands the avoidance of these poisons as much as possible through the use of the skillful will, and then collective action to eliminate them. A campaign against the sources of psychological smog and pollution, parallel to the present ecological campaign, it urgently needs to be started. It might be objected that, while one lives in the world, one cannot withdraw completely out of the range of these influences. This is true, but it can be done within certain limits. In many cases, one can deny them attention and interest. Moreover, exposure to them may be counteracted by disinfectant measures, during and after. Doctors and nurses working in departments of infectious diseases are not afraid of infection, but take precautionary measures, gloves, masks, use of disinfectants, etc. Similarly, we can have recourse to disinfectants and precautions against psychological poisons. What methods are to be used by the skillful will to achieve psychological hygiene? The fundamental one consists, as I have said, in withholding attention and interest. Most people can do this to a considerable extent once they understand the advantage of it. So it can be of great help to foresee in clear terms the harmful consequences of absorbing such poisons. An even more powerful approach is the already mentioned method of substitution, the cultivation of other, better interests, the systemic focusing of the attention on constructive things. This tends to give immunity to the negative, harmful, or poisonous influences. The most effective method, explained by Patanjali in his Yoga Sutras, is neutralization, which entails the active cultivation of qualities that are the antithesis of the harmful ones, harmlessness and non-violence in the face of violence, courage in the place of fear, joy in healthy pleasures instead of depression and despondency, moderation as a substitute for greed. As for overemphasis on sexuality, the most effective antidote is true love. It is thus not a question of not loving or of loving less, but of loving better. 4. The technique of evocative words. That certain words, such as serenity, courage, joy, compassion, have their effects on our moods and ideas, does not require demonstration. All words are symbols, that not only indicate or point out objects or psychological facts, but also possess the power of stimulating and arousing activity associated with them. They evoke and make operative the meanings and idea forces that they signify. This process follows principally three of the four laws referred to in the last chapter, laws 1, 6, and 8, pages 51, 56, and 58. According to these laws, every idea or image tends to produce the state of mind and the physical state and the acts that correspond to it. Attention and repetition reinforce the effectiveness of the idea or image. The effects of the idea or image, i.e. the activation of that which it signifies, are produced without our being aware of them. By using the technique of evocative words, we can apply these laws under the direction of the skillful will. The first step in using evocative words is to choose the one that expresses the quality we want to evoke and develop. We can then put a card with that word printed on it in a place where it will be easily noticed, where it will readily catch the eye, at the bedside, on a desk, on a table, or on a wall. Even if we do not consciously pay attention to it, the visual image produces an impression on our psyche, or more precisely, on our plastic, receptive unconscious, and gradually works on it. A stronger cumulative effect can be obtained by placing several cards with the same room in different places and rooms. This might be called a beneficent obsession. Bringing conscious attention to bear on the word provides an even more effective method. This can be done in various ways. 1. Assume a state of relaxation and observe the word attentively for a period of 1 or 2 minutes. If the ideas and images associated with the word emerge from the unconscious, let them come and record them. 2. Reflect on the meaning of the word and then record the results. 3. Try to feel the psychological quality that the word embodies, letting it permeate yourself, if possible, even to the point of identification with it. 4. While observing the word, say it aloud or murmur it. 5. Write the word many times. These methods combine visual, auditory, and motor images, and thereby increase the effectiveness of the exercise. The choice of which word to use can be made in one of two ways, either by deliberately choosing a word that corresponds to the quality that one desires to arouse and develop, or by choosing a word at random for a group of such words, and adopting it as the password for the day or for the period decided upon. The rhythm to be adopted may either be continuous use of the same word for a certain time, a week, a month, or more, followed by its repetition after an interval or rapid rotation, i.e. use the different word in a series every day. The preference to be given to one or other of these different methods depends not only on the individual's objective, but also his psychological type. So it is advisable to experiment with a number of them and then adopt the one that is most attuned to one's own constitution or that seems most rewarding. The following list includes some of the most often used evocative words. Others can be added to suit individual needs. Admiration, appreciation, attention, beauty, bliss, brotherhood, calm, compassion, comprehension, cooperation, courage, creativity, daring, decisiveness, detachment, determination, discernment, discipline, endurance, energy, enthusiasm, eternity, faith, freedom, friendship, generosity, goodness, goodwill, gratitude, harmony, humor, inclusiveness, infinity, initiative, integration, joy, liberation, light, love, order, patience, peace, persistence, positiveness, power, promptness, quiet, reality, renewal, resoluteness, serenity, service, silence, simplicity, synthesis, tenacity, truth, understanding, universality, vitality, wholeness, will, wisdom, wonder. And here we have a footnote. Some evocative phrases can be found at the end of the chapter on affirmation, page 177. Cards of some 20 commonly used words, printed in different colours and accompanied by a pamphlet with detailed instructions for their use, are available as packages from the Psychosynthesis Research Foundation, 40 East 49th Street, New York, New York. Returning to text. Such a use of words represents the simplest and most elementary application of the general method whereby psychological energies are employed to modify and direct states of mind and human behaviour. Some of the techniques which can be used for this purpose are displays of posters of a large size, suggestive phrases and slogans, persuasive and striking pictures, musical themes or excerpts that are associated with related words or phrases, and rhythmic movements, gestures and dances that symbolically express a message. This is a method of suggestion, or, as it is at present more euphemistically called, of persuasion, so widely and effectively used for commercial ends, and by means of which we are continually, and often unknowingly, led to act in ways that bring gain to others, although they may cause harm to ourselves. It is an effective example of the application of the skillful will, which is not necessarily accompanied by the goodwill. But such techniques can be just as effectively and systemically employed for higher and more constructive purposes. They can be used by any individual for his own growth, by a psychotherapist or teacher to help those he is guiding, and can eventually lead to the organisation and execution of widespread and intensive Episcopalian publicity campaigns directed towards individual and collective improvement and the uplifting of humanity. A word of caution is needed here. Sometimes the words are apt to arouse negative emotions. Some people will resent the simple appearance of a card with a pleasant word like joy, confidence, serenity, or courage. They may feel as if the words are preferring charges against them, as if the words are making them painfully aware of their lack of these qualities, and this irritates them. Sometimes both a positive and negative reaction is aroused, ambivalence. Consciously, there may be just a negative reaction, while the unconscious is favourably impressed. Or vice versa, the word can be appreciated by the conscious ego, but arouse resistance or antagonism from unconscious factors. It is well to become aware of such ambivalent reactions and to deal skillfully with them in appropriate ways. 5. The acting as if technique. This technique consists of acting as if one actually possessed the desired inner state. We have a footnote here. I will further discuss the appropriateness of using this technique on pages 142 through 144. Returning to text. It is based on the fact that, while the will can exercise only a limited direct control over emotions and feelings, and often no control at all, it can act much more directly and fully on physical attitudes and external actions. If, for example, we are sad and depressed, it is difficult to become cheerful or serene through a direct act of will. On the other hand, it is within our power to smooth our forehead, lift our head, smile, and speak words of harmony. confidence and joy. That is to say, we are able to behave as if we were cheerful and confident. Doing so gives, first of all, a feeling of freedom and confirms that we are not slaves of our ever-changing emotions, of our physiological and psychological conditions, which react to so many external causes, environmental circumstances, other people's influence, or the difficulties or uncertainties in any given situation. Thus we can, to a large extent, act, behave, and really be, in practice, as we would be if we possessed the qualities and enjoyed the mental states which we would like to have. But this is not all. More important, the use of this technique will actually change our emotional state. Little by little, and sometimes rapidly, the emotional state will follow, adapt itself to, and match the attitude and external behaviour. Tommaso Campanella used to imitate the facial expressions and gestures of people when he wanted to know what they were feeling. This, he had found, was a way of arousing corresponding feelings in himself. The operative law here is the second, see page 52. Attitudes, movements, and actions tend to evoke corresponding images and ideas. These, in turn, according to the next law, evoke or intensify corresponding emotions and feelings. The psychophysiological mechanism of this phenomenon can be explained in this way. Every external act requires that it first be imagined or visualized, even if unconsciously. But then during its performance, the self-observation that accompanies it creates an image that, in its turn, produces a reinforcing effect, a positive feedback process. It can be said that the as-if technique makes use of the same dynamic power of images as in suggestion, only in the reverse direction. In suggestion, the images arouse the feelings and emotions and then the corresponding actions. Acting as if, instead, one proceeds from the external act, which has been determined by the direction of the will, to the image of the act itself, and from the image to the corresponding emotional states. One often employs this technique spontaneously. It is common knowledge that whistling helps us to keep up one's courage in a lonely place at night. Singing, or getting others to sing, is a well-known spur to action. Machiavelli and Buffon both used Don Gala dress when about to write, having found that their styles reflected the attitude and mental state created by their costumes. There are examples of the use of this technique being implemented by determined acts of will, with successful and sometimes surprising results. The French general Turenne provides a historical one. His custom of marching resolutely in front of his troops going into battle earned him a reputation for great courage. They made war like that in those days. Someone once complimented him on his courage, and Turenne replied, "Of course, I conduct myself like a brave man, but all the time I'm feeling afraid. Naturally, I don't give in to the fear, but say to my body, 'Tremble, old carcass, but walk,' and my body walks." Turenne's behaviour demonstrated that the higher form of courage does not consist in having no feeling of fear, but in acting as if one had none. A still more striking example of the effectiveness of the technique is given by Goethe, and deserves to be related in his own words. "I found myself in a state of health which furthered me sufficiently in all that I would and should undertake. Only there was a certain irritability left behind, which did not always let me be in equilibrium. A long sound was disagreeable to me. Diseased objects awakened in me loathing and horror. But I was particularly troubled by a giddiness which came over me every time I looked down from a height. All these infirmities I tried to remedy, and indeed I wished to lose no time, in a somewhat violent way. In the evening, when they beat the tattoo, I went near the multitude of drums, the powerful rolling and beating of which have made one's heart burst in one's bosom. All alone I ascended the highest pinnacle of the Minster spire, and sat in what is called the neck, under the roof or crown, for a quarter of an hour, before I would venture to step out again into the open air, where standing upon a platform scarce an L square, without any particular holding, one sees the boundless prospect before, while the nearest objects and ornaments conceal the church, and everything upon and above which one stands. This is exactly as if one saw oneself carried up into the air in a balloon. Such troublesome and painful sensations I repeated until the impression became quite indifferent to me, and I have since then derived great advantage from this training, in mountain travels and geological studies and on great buildings, where I have vied with the carpenters in running over the bare beams and two cornices of the edifice, and even in Rome, where one must run similar risks to obtain a nearer view of important works of art. Anatomy also was of double value to me, as it taught me to tolerate the most repulsive sights while I satisfied my thirst for knowledge, and thus I attended also the clinical course of the elder Dr. Ehrman, as well as the lectures of his son on obstetrics, with the double view of becoming acquainted with all conditions, and of freeing myself from all apprehension as to repulsive things. And I have actually succeeded so far that nothing of this kind could ever put me out of my self-possession. But I sought to steel myself not only against these impressions of the scenes, but also against the infections of the imagination, the awful and shuddering impressions of the darkness in churchyards, solitary places, churches and chapels by night, and whatever may be connected with them. I contrived to render likewise indifferent, and this also I went so far that day and night and every locality were quite the same to me. So that even when, in later times, a desire came over me once more to feel in such senses a pleasing shudder of youth, I could scarcely force this in any degree by the strongest and most fearful images which I called up. This drastic method of Goths, however, is not within the capacity of everyone, for it presupposes a possession or the previous development of a strong and determined will. But the as-if technique can be applied gradually and facilitated by the help of other techniques. This is, of course, strongly advocated and frequently applied in psychosynthesis. When a particular technique by itself fails to obtain a desired result, various ones in combination can succeed. In fact, the art of harnessing a selected team of techniques in the same undertaking may be said to be a specific task of the skillful, wise will. When it is necessary or desired to overcome strong adverse tendencies or emotions, fear for instance, it is frequently helpful to precede the acting as if technique with that of the ideal model. This entails visualizing ourselves as we want to become, seeing ourselves in imagination, acting in the manner in which we would like to act in an actual practice. This method of self-training is similar to an actor's rehearsals, alone or with others, of the part he is to play later in public. But when the performance of some action in reality is fraught with acute or largely repressed fear, it can often happen that this imaginative evocation has the result of magnifying such a fear to the point of inducing a severe anxiety crisis. In such cases, the preliminary use of another technique, that of imaginative training or desensitization, will help to change the situation. Here we have a footnote. It is described in Psychosynthesis, page 226. Another technique, which can be used independently of, or in succession to, that of imaginative training, is external training. If one gradually accustoms oneself to doing something which at first arouses aversion, the unwillingness diminishes little by little and finally disappears. This fact has an important and extensive application in the educational field. Parents should carefully avoid, if at all possible, forcing a child to do something which frightens it. They can instead teach it by degrees to get rid of the inhibiting aversion. For example, going into the sea to bathe, or in the case of a very small child, walking and so on. It is important to get a small child gradually accustomed to and familiar with what arouses fear, after which he can be persuaded to perform any appropriate action without danger of repression. This is the proper approach also for adults who have some intense, undesirable emotion, where there are means and time for applying it. But in cases of necessity, in which sudden and unforeseen situations crop up and there is not time for this, one can command the body to act as if it did not feel the emotion. Let us call it the Turenne method. End of chapter 6.